Okay, thanks. My name's Phil Landry. I'm a postdoc at the University of Chicago and a member of the LIGO Scientific Collaboration. And I was invited to speak about tides and quasi-universal relations for neutron stars. We've heard a bit about these things through many of the other talks this morning, so I'll try and collect the bits and pieces and synthesize it. So first off, as we have also already heard, the equation of state of matter at ultra-high densities is not well known. Fortunately, the details of the nuclear microphysics that, you know, nuclear microphysics taking place on femtometer scales, those details imprint on the kilometer scale macroscopic observables in the neutron star. And so, through observations of, you know, the radii and other macroscopic observables, we can probe this unknown equation of state. So on the gravitational wave side, the macroscopic observables that are sensitive to internal structure are tidal parameters. And just as an equation of state will predict a unique mass radius curve, every equation of state will predict a particular mass dependence for these tidal parameters. So during binary coalescence, there are a number of different kinds of tidal effects that impact the waveform. In the early inspiral, you can have nonlinear tides like the PG mode coupling that Reed talked about that will turn on before other tidal effects come to dominate. Later in the inspiral, you can get dynamical tides, so excitation or even resonance of the fundamental oscillation modes of the neutron star. For neutron star black hole mergers with particular mass ratios, you may even get tidal disruption. All these things tell you something about the internal structure of the neutron stars. For the bulk of the inspiral, though, it's static tides that dominate, and this is the tidal effect that LIGO and Virgo have currently measured. So during the inspiral, the stars are reasonably well separated, and what this means is that the tidal field that one star experiences from its companion is relatively weak and slowly varying, and so we can treat the tidal perturbation at linear order, and we can work in a kind of adiabatic approximation by which the fluid inside the star responds almost instantaneously to the tidal field. In this regime, then, the quadrupolar tidal bulge induced on one star by the tidal field is just measured by this parameter called tidal deformability, which tells you its size in units of the applied tidal field. So it's sensitive to the mass of the neutron star and to the equation of state. And if you go ahead and integrate the internal structure of the star to calculate what the tidal deformability is, you find it's a decreasing function of the neutron star mass. And in this plot, the up and down variation is due to changes, different equations of state. So basically, if your equation of state is stiffer, meaning you have larger pressure gradients, more support against gravitational collapse, you have a larger tidal deformability, and vice versa. Now, tidal deformabilities impact the waveform phasing. This is because they produce two effects that come in at the same post-Newtonian order. One is by putting quadrupole moments on the star, you actually enhance the relative acceleration of the binary slightly. So you accelerate the coalescence. The other effect is by adding individual quadrupoles on your star, you actually add to the orbital quadrupole moment and source a bit more gravitational radiation through the quadrupole formula. And putting those two things together, you end up in the waveform phase with this term at fifth post-Newtonian order, which is essentially the weighted average of the tidal deformabilities of, you know, star 1 and star 2. And it's this lambda tilde, the chirp deformability or binary deformability, which LIGO and Virgo are most sensitive to. All right, so tides are interesting because they're one way in which we can distinguish the gravitational waveform of a black hole versus neutron stars. That's because the tidal deformability vanishes for black holes. This was shown by Binnington and Poisson for non-rotating black holes by doing an explicitly gauge-invariant construction and solving the perturbation equations for black holes. But more recently, it was proved in a much more general context by Gerlebeck as really an extension of the classic no-hair theorems of general relativity. So the fact that, you know, tidal deformability vanishes for a black hole is tied in some intrinsic way to the inherent simplicity of black holes. If we turn to neutron stars, the situation is much more complicated because of this equation of state dependence. There's all kinds of observables which in principle depend separately on the equation of state. So radii, tidal deformabilities, moment of inertia, rotational quadrupole, you have F-mode frequency, you even have post-merger frequencies. All these things, in principle, depend separately on the equation of state, but as we already heard in Niels's talk, there's some degree of redundancy in these observables because they are all ultimately tying back to the same, you know, function of structure. So what would be great is if for neutron stars we had some sort of analog of the no-hair theorems for black holes that allows us to eliminate this redundancy and just boil things down to a small set of observables. So is there such a relation for neutron stars? Well, luckily, Yagi and Yunus in a 2013 paper say effectively yes, at least in an approximate way. So in their paper called I Love Q, they looked at the dimensionless moment of inertia, so that's the moment of inertia divided by mass cubed, tidal deformability, and the rotational quadrupole, which is the quadrupole moment induced by the neutron star's spin. And they just plotted pairs of these quantities against one another for a wide set of realistic equations of state. And what they discovered were empirical relations between these observables. So even though the moment of inertia and tidal deformability depend individually on the equation of state, their relation is virtually insensitive to the equation of state. So what we see here is there's this neat trend with residual variation due to the equation of state on the order of 1% or less. So what this means is that if you know the tidal deformability for one neutron star from, say, gravitational waves, you effectively get the moment of inertia and the quadrupole moment for free, modulo this small uncertainty. I Love Q is not the only example of these so-called quasi-universal relations for neutron stars. So there are relations that implicate the compactness, the dimensionless mass to radius ratio. There's ones that involve the F-mode frequencies, also the post-merger frequencies, as we've heard before. And what I want to do next is basically tell you, well, what are these things good for? So we have these approximate universal relations which connect the properties of neutron stars. What can we do with them? So in the original I Love Q paper, there are sort of three canonical applications which are listed: inferring unobservable properties, testing gravity, and breaking degeneracies, or reducing redundant information. So the first application, in terms of inferring unobservable properties, I give as an example the LIGO-Virgo radii and equation of state paper, which Jocelyn mentioned as well. So the parameters that are inferred directly from the gravitational waves are the individual tidal deformabilities of the neutron stars, lambda 1 and lambda 2, which produces, this green shaded posterior here. But if we're interested in asking what does this mean for the radii of neutron stars, one way to do this without actually having to parameterize or model the equation of state directly is to use a quasi-universal relation. And so using one between the compactness and the tidal deformability called the C-Love relation, one can simply, take the tidal deformability values that are inferred and map them into a compactness, but since there's also some measurement of the masses, that can be turned into a posterior on the radii. And what we see for 17.817 is that the posteriors inferred this in this way for radii are consistent with both stars, agreeing in radius, having a similar radii. And if you fold in the mass posteriors as well, you can produce these two-dimensional contours here. So that's one example of how universal relations have been used to infer, an observable that we can't see directly. In terms of testing gravity, it's interesting because in modified theories of gravity, the universal relations seem to exist, but they, at least in many cases, are different than in general relativity. So here's an example of the QI universal relation. This is the GR fit. And in dynamical Chern-Simons gravity, you get an equally universal relation, variation still below the percent level, but the best fit is completely different. And so what this means is that if you can somehow observe these two quantities for a neutron star, you can actually start testing deviations from general relativity. Okay, so before getting to the last application in terms of breaking degeneracies, I want to introduce another kind of universal relation. These are called the binary love relations, also introduced by Yagi and Yunus. And they are different in nature than the I Love Q type ones because they will relate observables for two different neutron stars. So in this case, what's plotted is a symmetric combination of the two tidal deformabilities for, a pair of neutron stars and an anti-symmetric combination. And what you find is that depending on the mass ratio between these two stars, you get very neat fits, again, with limited uncertainty, limited scatter. And so what's happening here is that the tidally formed abilities 1 and 2 for a pair of neutron stars that share the same equation of state, we believe there's just one equation of state for all neutron stars in nature, those two tidal parameters aren't actually independent. They're correlated tightly because they have to live along the same mass versus lambda curve. And what the binary law relations are telling you is something about those correlations, so they can't vary independently. It just so happens that constructing these symmetric and anti-symmetric combinations reduces the amount of residual equation of state dependence in the relations, but fundamentally, this is encoding some physical correlations between the component tidal deformabilities in a neutron star binary. So, admittedly, the universality is not as good for the binary Love relations as for the ILoveQ type ones, but that's fine because this gives you at least, you know, a prediction, a best fit about which you can model the uncertainty as, you know, some sort of Gaussian error. Okay, so with these binary relations, we can actually do some really great stuff in terms of better constraining tidal parameters from binary neutron star mergers. So Chatsuyanu and collaborators introduced this method to involve the binary relation in the parameter estimation to effectively end up reducing the 90% confidence interval, in this case, of the posterior in lambda 1 and lambda 2. This is for an injected signal with a particular equation of state called H4 and an equal mass ratio. But what's shown in orange here is the tidal deformabilities for the components that you recover if you do not model this physical correlation between lambda 1 and lambda 2. But the minute you do, by effectively getting rid of one of the tidal parameters through this universal relation, you see that the posterior area you recover is much reduced. In particular, you end up cutting out half of the plane here where lambda 2 would be smaller than lambda 1. That makes physical sense because, as I showed before, lambda is a monotonically decreasing function of mass, and M2 is smaller than M1. And so what this means is that compared to the original LVC detection paper inference of the tides, you get a much tighter 90% or 50% confidence region in the posterior. In particular, you rule out, you know, this whole part of the plane, but you also start to be able to distinguish the tides in 1708-17 from, you know, the zero tides that would be there if there were black holes involved, right? So at 50% confidence, basically, you can rule out no tides after using these universal relations. Okay, so I want to talk about one more application here, which is, we have binary Love relations, we have ILoveQ type relations, what happens if we try and combine them? So we've heard a bit about the double pulsar already. It's going to be a target for a moment of inertia measurement as soon as the square kilometer array gets up and running. You know, that's going to be interesting because it will provide a different channel through which we can probe the equation of state. But we actually know something about the equation of state from 1708-17, and what we can do is, using these quasi-universal relations, actually ask what 1708-17 tells us already about the moment of inertia. So we can effectively make a gravitational wave-based prediction for what the moment of inertia should be, and then compare the eventual electromagnetic measurement to that. And the way that works is simply we measure tidal deformability. One way to express that is in terms of the canonical deformability, so the deformability of a 1.4 solar mass star. If we have that from LIGO, we simply use the binary Love relation to map from lambda 1.4 to lambda for a 1.34 mass solar mass star, which is the mass of the primary and the double pulsar. And then we can use an ILoveQ type relation that maps the tidal deformability into the moment of inertia. What you end up with is a number like this, 1.16 times 10 to the 45 grams per centimeter squared. But what's important here are the error bars. So these error bars are quantifying the uncertainty that we have in the equation of state due to this residual equation of state dependence of the universal relations. And so you can imagine doing the same thing also for the dimensionless spin of this pulsar, which is interesting because the primary here is the second fastest spinning pulsar in a double neutron star that will merge within a Hubble time. And so it's relevant for sort of the upper limit of the spin distribution for such pulsars. And just taking this estimate of the moment of inertia, you end up seeing that at 90% confidence, the dimensionless spin, so the spin to mass squared ratio, has to be less than 0.03 or so. And again, the error bars here are sort of meaningfully quantifying the residual uncertainty in the equation of state. Okay, so I've told you about all the great things we can do with quasi-universal relations, given some examples of how they've already been used. But the question remains, you know, what is the origin of these universal relations? So, why I love Q, this was the title of a paper by Kent Yagi and collaborators where they tried to get to the bottom of this. So, one thing they had suggested was that this universality in compact stars is a product of an emergent symmetry that has to do with what they called self-similarity of isodensity contours. What this means basically is as you flow from non-compact to compact stars and you look at the radial profile of eccentricity throughout the deformed stars, the more compact the star, the more uniform that eccentricity profile is. And somehow that emergent symmetry is giving rise to these universal relations. So that sort of intuition or physical picture was largely confirmed by follow-up studies by Sham et al. And Chan et al. So in the Sham paper, what they did was look at incompressible stars, so uniform density stars. And it turns out that for uniform density stars, the universal relations are exact. So they, you know, there's no longer this scatter about the fit, but the fit is exact now between, say, moment of inertia and tidal deformability. And further, they perturbatively expanded about uniform density solutions, where delta here is, you know, the perturbation away from incompressibility, and found basically that the Ilov relation is stationary about these perturbations. So what this means physically is that compact stars, in order to support themselves against gravity, have to be very stiff. They're in fact so stiff in terms of the equation of state that they are very close to incompressible. And when they are exactly incompressible, you basically get the Ilov Q relations automatically. And it's because of the structure of the perturbations about this incompressible limit that these things persist even for small deviations from incompressibility. And then just to tie it all together, incompressibility also produces this uniform eccentricity profile. So that sort of confirms the physical picture that Yagi et al. Suggested. Okay, so in my remaining few minutes, I want to get back to tides, which is what I started the presentation with. The tidal deformability we discussed is the leading order tidal effect that enters at 5 pn. But as you go to higher post-Newtonian orders, there are other kinds of tidal effects that come into play, things that are only present in general relativity or relativistic theories of gravity. So lambda, the tidal deformability, is just the analog of the Newtonian tidal deformability that you'd get with, you know, standard 1 over r squared gravity. However, at 6 pn, so one post-Newtonian order higher, you start getting gravitomagnetic tidal effects that impact the waveform phase. Gravitomagnetic tides are sourced not by the mass distribution of the companion, but by its orbital motion, so its momentum distribution. And just as in electromagnetism, you can get magnetic induction of a current, what the gravitomagnetic tides produce are fluid currents inside the star. And these fluid currents will have an impact on the tidal phasing because they're taking energy out of the orbit. So that enters at 6 pn. At 6.5 pn, it gets even more exciting because now you start coupling the individual spins of the neutron stars to the tides. This is general relativity. It's a nonlinear theory. So if the stars are spinning, that spin will couple to the tides. Rather remarkably, the spin from one star will couple to the quadrupole and octupole tidal fields, and vice versa for the gravitomagnetic fields, but all these effects end up coming out at 6.5 pn, which is only half a pn order above the gravitomagnetic effects, and also at 6 pn there's a correction term that's related to lambda that comes in, so it's not at much higher pn order. And then at 7 pn you start getting the octupole effects, so this is the analog of the tidal deformability, but sourced by the octupole part of the tidal field. So going forward, as you know, we get better detectors, more sensitive detectors, and more of the in-spiral starts rising above the noise, it will become more and more important to model these additional tidal effects accurately so that we're not, you know, systematically biasing our tidal recovery. Luckily, universal relations can also save the day here. So as Kent Yagi has shown, and as myself and collaborators have shown, there are these universal relations between all these higher-order tidal parameters. So here, for instance, the regular tidal deformability, the gravitomagnetic deformability, you see they have this neat trend with, you know, a few percent level residual EOS variation. And what this means is that when you're constructing waveforms that are trying to include these effects, you don't have to go out and calculate, you know, all six more, you know, higher-order tidal effects. You can just use these relations and you know, in this way, model these effects. So this has been done already for some EOB waveforms, like one of the TOB resums. But, you know, going forward, this will become more and more important. And in my last minute or two here, let me just take stock and talk about, you know, what's coming next. So I hope I've convinced you that, you know, universal relations are useful. They really reduce the redundancy in these different observable ways of measuring the equation of state. I gave an argument for why there's universality. One open question is this argument in terms of incompressibility, does it explain universal relations with the oscillation frequencies and also with post-merger observables? That's unclear. One really interesting thing is that recently, equations of state that have strong first-order phase transitions, so jumps like this in energy density at fixed pressure, can produce these twin branches where basically for a given mass you can have two solutions, one being a quark star, one being a hadronic star. This sort of twin branch behavior appears to violate the binary Love relation, so that's the dashed green lines here that depart from the trend. And although this is a challenge for universal relations, it's also a great opportunity because I think this can allow us to hunt for twin branches in nature by looking for deviations from these universal relations, right? Instead of waiting to see two stars of, say, two solar masses with different radii, we can maybe just probe things in the space of the binary Love relation and see if already with a few observations there's some deviation from this trend. So I'll end with that thought, and I'm happy to take questions.
For your moment of inertia inference that you did with Kumar, have you looked into what this implies for the maximum mass? And I'm asking because we took one of your earlier results, but basically topping off at about 1.5 times 10 to the 45.
Right.
And it looked like this isn't going to allow maximum masses more than about 1.92 solar masses. Have you investigated this?
I haven't investigated that specifically, but built into that calculation, you know, I think we had used the maximum mass, you know, the 1.93 pulsar, the existence of that pulsar, to constrain the equations of state we were fitting, right? So the variation, residual variation in the universal relations is assuming that, you know, we have a 1.93 solar mass pulsar. The other thing is the relations were calculated only for the ranges of masses, one solar mass to two solar masses, I believe. So it may be in that way sensitive, you know, if you're asking about the maximum mass, because there's some assumptions baked in about the maximum mass, it may be sensitive in that way. But maybe we should talk in detail about what's going on.
Other questions or comments?
So one of the points that you made about the universality of the I Love Q relations is that it's related essentially, or you can motivate it, how it arises from the constant density stars. I'm not entirely sure I understand the argument because, correct me if I'm wrong, Ken and Philip, if the I Love Q relations actually arise because we are focusing on the nuclear equations of state. That if you really deviate significantly from the nuclear theory based essential equations of state, I think you get a different result. And so the constant density stars are not really models for realistic equations of state. So it's not entirely clear to me because if that this motivates precisely the idea of how the what the emergence is behind of the the reason for the emergence of the I Love Q relations. Mm-hmm. Are the I Love Q relations for the constant density stars anywhere close to the I Love Q relations of the?
I think they agree in the Newtonian limit. I think they're exact, but maybe Kent knows better.
So in terms of polytropes, at the polytropic index, n equals 0 corresponds to constant transistor, and realistic neutron star falls roughly within n equals 0.5 to 1. Then, so I love correlation for, let's say, n equals 1 is very close to I love correlation for n equals 0 constant density star. But if we crank up this polytropic index to n equals 2 or 3, then you're right that we start to see deviation. So it's just that realistic equilibrium state in terms of I love correlation is very similar to constant density star.
Yeah. So I think the variations you're thinking about are in the direction opposite from incompressibility, right? Limiting it in that way. Whereas most equations of state for realistic neutron stars are already in the regime where they're close to incompressible.
Other questions and comments? Maybe people are just hungry. Okay, well, let's thank Philip again.
Thank you.
See you back here at 2:30.